That A I that ain't S A saying much that you're better than Hillary. It's not saying much to say that Frank is better than Hillary.
Frank, you're right again. Okay, you are correct, my friend. In fact, that's a half inch from a damn insult. Because you know, no, look. Do you know what Hillary Clinton said? And you have to wonder about, you know, Bill and Hillary. I'm not going down that aisle with the sex stuff. Uninteresting. Even the president needs to get polished off. My fellow Americans, y'all leave that man alone about that nonsense. But what about the working class? And what about their lack of class? These people were leaving the White House. Do you remember, this is just a real quick thing, just to show you the level of discussion you're about to get involved with. Bill Clinton started basically selling pardons. Ask me how I know. A criminal actually, through his brother, lobbied for himself to be released. And Bill sure to do it. It got out in the papers. His brother had to give the money back. Hillary's brother. It was Hillary's brother. No, parvo. What's the word for parvo riche?
They.
What?
They were the ones who HUNIU undid. Welfare.
Mm-hmm.
The Clintons are the ones who undid
this,
welfare.
Excuse me, you're being too kind, Frank. When you go on your presidential stump, I insist, because I read this, and it made me think about it, right? The Clintons actually attacked and dismantled more of the positive results of Roosevelt, I'll say the Rooseveltian reforms, of the 30s than any other prior president, including Reagan and Bush, the first.
They.
Man, that's, they that were, give you a sense.
They were the ones who UINTR introduced the Patriot Act. The Clintons are the ones that introduced the Patriot Act.
It was through something called, that's why we call him, my man Tracy and I, we always call him Crying Bill Clinton. Because most people like to just forget, because America, you know, you forget. I'm glad they forgot about poor little Kobe stuff and let him have his little fun with his MVP. But mostly people forget, you know, in America. What Gorby Dow, he said Americans have a political memory of 72 hours. And that's about right. Like a fucking goldfish.
But you have to remember, Gerald, that before the Patriot Act, there was the King Alfred Act back in the 50s, right after World War II. The King Alfred Act.
Tell me about the King Alfred Act. Well, people know about the Patriot Act, but I don't think they know about the King.
The King Alfred Act was a continuation of the concentration camp era, but it was only on paper, though. The Department of Defense, having come full-fledged then, had designed a program which would have segregated the communities, particularly the black communities, so that if there were any uprisings, any insurrections, they would have been bounded in by the military forces. And so this was all part of the defense, Department of Defense idea. It never became public. And it was only released after the Black Panther Party had gained access to the material that showed that these were the things that were going to happen in the urban centers if things became uncontrollable during the time, especially during the beginnings of the civil rights movement, and particularly during the times leading up to the protests and insurrections up in the 1960s. But the King Alfred Act was in place. That was on paper. And the Patriot Act, when things began to happen internationally, all they did was dust off something that was already there and gave it a new name.
Just, ladies and gentlemen, before you think, my friend and brother, Mike, I'm sorry, Lord have mercy, look at me, I'm old.
Steve.
Yeah, Steve, brother Steve McCutcheon, and what's my name? And Gerald, listen, being in the Panthers will make your ass paranoid. But that's not paranoia right there. Because when I talk about the crime bill Clinton thing, we talking about his crime bill was over 1,000 pages. People often in the U.S. Congress and Senate voted for it without reading the whole thing. But it had a very negative piece in there, and that was that effective Death Penalty Act, which has changed the death penalty in America, where you can no longer appeal your death penalty on the basis of your innocence. The only way that you can get another hearing is claiming that in some way a procedural problem occurred that was dealt with by the judge in an improper way. And that's fine. Those appeals should exist. But given the fact that as high as 25% of the death penalties given out are given to the wrong people, and I'm talking about innocent people, and yes, that is a fact. That's the 25. Yeah. They fuck up that much. I'm sorry. They make that many errors. And no, it's a problem now because, you know, we've seen people exonerated because their DNA stuff or other evidence. You know, the Effective Death Penalty Act is going to choke that and prevent those cases from coming out.
That. A. L. O. That alone should be enough to end the DEA death penalty.
Only in a place where people are intellectually clear and consistent. And that's one of the reasons we're happy to be here with you tonight. Because we're trying to add to the clarity and kind of, you know, clean up that muddy water so people can understand what's going on.
That is why I am you running for president.
Okay.
And one thing about the death penalty that, I mean, it's been said historically so many years before that the measure of a civilization is determined by how it treats its prisoners, those who have been incarcerated.
Absolutely.
And those who have been sentenced to death in this country far exceeds any place on this planet. Together, we have more people on death row in this country than any place in the world. Any place in the world. And this is supposed to be the most powerful, the most foremost industrial, technological territory in the world. The barbarity here, socially here, diminishes the people here who are trying to be progressive, who are trying to progress above things that are being done to individuals here. So what the governments have done, what the government processions, the government parades have done here is an embarrassment to all the things that have been written here legally over the years, all the things that have been written socially, politically, all is an embarrassment to the activism, to all the consciousness that has been given to the people who have died and committed themselves over the years. That is an embarrassment that you have so many people who have died on death row, who are waiting to die here, and will eventually be sentenced because the social policy has been thrown into the gutters.
Two, one, in, one, zero, zero,
one in
100 mm-hmm. is in jail right now. One out of every 100 people in the United States is in jail right now.
About right. That's not good. It's not good. What do you got? What is it? It's about 2 million, right? So that's about one. That's pretty close to one.
At some level of incarceration between the city, county, state, and federal incarceration, or on some form of probation or parole.
W, H, I, which, K, E, keeps us. G, F, R, O, from. D, E, V, E. Developing, developing, L, E, A, leaders, which keeps us from developing leaders.
Okay. Well, it slows it down. They can't stop it. Leaders develop themselves also. So let's face it. As long as we are in a society where, you know, there's little work, little is being produced, where the gas is going sky high, where 75% of the kids are dropping out of school. We're talking Oakland and Detroit, for instance. You know, that's a big number. I couldn't believe that, except I heard it more than once.
That's, Gerald alludes to leaders, presidents, governors, senators, congressmen, congresswomen, whatever. Sure. Put anybody in office, any place that you want. Ron Dellums in Oakland, whoever you want. The leader's not going to make any difference. Mm-hmm. That president, that governor, that senator, it's not going to make any difference. It is the organized structure of the people, neighborhood by neighborhood, who make the difference.
Yeah. Organization.
You vote someone in, fine. If you sit back, and wait for them to do something, the same thing is going to happen year in, year out, community by community. Nothing is going to happen. All people are going to do is sit back and complain. He didn't do that.
Yeah.
She didn't do that. So it goes to the heart of any issue. Go back to communal days. Mm-hmm. At the tribal level, it was a... Things that were being accomplished at the tribal level. That means everyone met together, everyone worked together, everyone enforced what was going on. They proceeded to carry out things to affect change.
But
even though the state, the apparatus now has grown so large, so huge, so complex now, it still can be done.
That is. What they don't want.
Exactly.
The T R I tribes. That's what they don't want. The tribes.
Well, tribes, self organization of any type.
The.
You know, of any type. They don't want to see people unified.
M community. They don't want the community.
No. I'm sorry, I slipped away. I didn't even finish my sentence. But what I was getting towards, and because sometimes it's so depressing, you get to ponder about it. Jesus Christ. But What I was getting ready to say was, see, this Effective Death Penalty Act is touching on a very important case right now, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. This cat, most people in the world, having read the information, I got into it. I read his legal briefs, did work with the lawyer, traveled all around the country doing work for Mumia Abu-Jamal. But truth be told now, this dude is in trouble. Serious trouble. Federal court, appeals court, just turned down his appeal. And what's happening is that the Philadelphian legal establishment, whatever you might want to call them, just full of people who have misjudged his case, by the way. I never saw a situation where the whole apparatus had a vested interest to keep this man in jail. Because if it's proven that he was framed, what does that say about them? You see? Oh, yeah, because it definitely says something, because they all played a role in helping to keep this guy, you know, in prison. And they're going to they claim that they have the option of retrying him for the death penalty. I can't see, you know, I would stop that if I could, because there's nothing in it for him. In other words, if he goes to court, they can reinstate the death penalty or they can keep him in prison for the rest of his life. But he can't have a new trial. They only want to adjudicate only the sentence. Isn't that some crazy stuff? Mm-hmm. That's some crazy stuff. Because they try to say, you know, everybody knows that they pull some scandalous moves. But they only want to allow the examination of the racial bias. You know, they expel people off the jury. Like these cats, they expel like 40 black people off the jury. Out of the jury pool, excuse me. And it's crazy stuff. Okay. Stuff that would never stand up.
Okay, Gerald, and because Mumia's case has received such international attention over the years, that's why it's being highlighted. But the other point, okay, that's at the tip of the iceberg. All through history of all African Americans in particular, those cases have been happening. There are historical cases, judicial cases, which have been happening, but they have not received the recognition. Mumia's case happens to be because of his relationship to the Black Panther Party. The other case, you forget the Scottsboro Boys, back then. Mm-hmm. You forget many of the other cases that only received prominence because of the attention that those who felt that the legal system was in error caught the attention of the American people. Okay, not American people, not the American judicial system, not the American legislative system. So those things caught the attention of people at a particular time and have been carried on by people who thought they could change the system. The legal system has not changed. The judicial system has not changed. Mm-hmm. Concessions have only been made because of those cases. So Mumia's case,
because of the mass support of those cases.
That's it. And it's only going to make concession. It's not going to change anything qualitatively within the judicial or legislative system. And going back to Huey's case in 1967, 1968, Huey's case, when voir dire was first introduced as a part of the jury process, that was a qualitative change in terms of what happened in terms of jury selecting juries. Those qualitative changes there, it did make a difference. And the decision that even though it was a compromise, it was a concession in Huey's verdict, those compromises now are few and far between. Few and far between. And the not guilty verdicts or the guilty of a lesser crime, those are concessions that social policy is willing to let the American public feel that someone has been given a fair and equal trial by jury or has been entitled to due process by law. But for the masses of American people, They are not the justice. The justice there is so imbalanced there.
She's absolutely right, bro.
You can drop a feather on one hand and you can drop a brick on this hand here. But the American justice system is still as imbalanced as it was created when a handful of white men decided they would deliver justice. They would deliver the political systems for and the social economies. And in the social ideas and policies for this country here. It is so imbalanced and it's ingrained right now. It's still ingrained to these days, and people are just living these things even though they've been trying to pass them on and trying to understand them, but those things are still surfacing in not only in our policies organizationally, but even though some individually, those things are still coming to fore.
Let me just throw the Dred Scott decision. I think that's a fairly important decision in that show. When
you became a Panther, did you have H.O. Hope? You're asking who, Steve, or both? Both of you. Did you have hope when you became a Panther?
Hope for, you talking about Obama kind of hope? I never fucked with that too much. That Obama-sized hope.
For the C-H-A change.
See,
we K-N know is needed.
Look, when I was growing up, my family moved from the South. I think that was a plus. Went to school, learned how to read. That was a plus. Civil rights movement was just blossoming all around me. And the consciousness of the people was also pretty high in the black community. It was different. When I remember in the 50s, when the FBI used to come looking for communists in our community, people just slammed their door in their face. They got very little cooperation in the black community during that period. I hate to think about what would happen now, given the lack, the disintegration of much consciousness, the decay of, it's not the days of old. I know that, okay? So, yeah, clearly, not only did we have hope, we were confident that there was going to be change. I personally didn't believe American capitalism would continue to stand. When I was 17, I started listening to them Crazy Panthers. I think it was over. Now the question is, how many people would die in the resistance and civil war, and that's kind of where I was. I was a little bit ahead of the curve on that because I clearly wasn't right.
And when I came into the party, into the Black Panther Party, I was politically naive. Academically, I was at the top of the curve, but in terms of what was happening politically, in the social dynamics. Someone told, when I first hit the Black Panther Party, someone told me, oppression. We were fighting for a revolution. We're trying to build a particular period where there will be a revolutionary process. Or what? I know about the American Revolution. We're talking about a revolution here. I didn't have a clue. Come from academics into something totally, totally different at the other end of what I had learned. Mm-hmm. But from the point where I began using what I had learned academically and taking the material that I had learned from the party, okay, from the historical learnings of third world countries, from the historical learnings of other people's struggles, I had leaped. I made leaps in terms of what I learned in 12 years in all of my public school, public education, what I had the 2 years at Morgan State College, all of that paled. That had nothing to do with what I learned in the first 2 years in the Black Panther Party, going through the materials that I was told to read, talking to people.
You wanted to read it, though.
Talking to people.
You were motivated.
Talking to people. What I began to absorb, I was absorbing. Mm. I was absorbing things. And by being able to translate that material. And then the genius of Huey P. Newton put it all into focus. Mm. Taking what I had learned, taking the things that I had seen other people bring to us. Those things showed me, you grew up ignorant. I thought I was the dumbest Panther ever to walk through the door up until I started putting things together, until I started listening, understanding, and being able to see day to day what was going on in my neighborhoods, and then hearing people under the surface, and then being able to listen to the news under the current, not what they were saying on NBC, CBS, ABC, being able to hear things that weren't there and talking to people who have been in the trenches, the Vietnamese, the Palestinians, those who have been there with Che Guevara, those who would be there in Chile, those type of struggles, the people who came out of the Congo, people who were there with Lumumba, people who were there in the old struggles, in Europe, in Spain, in the struggles between France and Germany, those struggles. I found out that the United States media, the government, social policy makers, they were giving us one story, which were in the history books, but the true story came from the people who were there. And even though they say history is written by the makers, is written by those who rule, history is written by those who are there. Okay, and that's what I learned through the Black Panther Party.
And that's why you wrote that book.
Because I'm still here.
Yeah.
I had a chance to write that book.
What? What book?
This one here. Mm. Let me get it on out here. I'm proud of my little brother right here, because you know why? He ain't just talk about education. He has become a piece of the structure here. Look at this. We were free for a while. Back to Back in the Black Panther Party by Steve D. McCutcheon, a.k.a. Lil Mansa. So this is Steve's contribution to the already formidable body of literature that concerns the Black Panthers. We'll talk about that body of literature in a little bit, but we want to hear what, you know, Frank and Steve got to say on this stuff.
R, D, E, F, define, B, four, A, W, H, I, a while, define for a while.
Yeah. See, you the one gave it that name. Right. You know you got to defend
and,
that.
And it's you look at the existence of the Black Panther Party, the things that happened that brought the Black Panther Party into existence, all of the conditions before the Civil Rights Movement, even before then, we're looking at the conditions of Joe Louis, Jack Johnson. We're looking at conditions back during the 1800s, even before the Emancipation Proclamation. All those things led up to the Black Panther Party, up until after the assassination of Malcolm X, the assassination of Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy. All those conditions were created internally and externally. Okay, conditions outside the country, as well as what was happening in our communities, what was happening to Black folks on a day-to-day basis, all those conditions, economically, socially, politically, personally, all of those things led to the creation of the Black Panther Party, and it was no social accident. Okay, it just happened that Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale were the ones who who caroused those ideas and actions, who were able to harness and focus those ideas.
But why you felt you was free, though? Just explain, to break that down.
Once they put that
and for a while.
Yeah, and let him explain it. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Once the idea was set into motion, we existed within the laws, but we existed on our own terms. We understood. We obeyed the laws, but we stood head to head, toe to toe with any of the challenges. And so the United States government, even though they abused us, they trampled on our rights and the rights of others. We always maintained our dignity. We maintained our freedom. Within the constraints of the United States government, we were free. We were free, even though those outside powers conspired and did attack us. So we were free then to do what we had to do.
We C-R-E-A, create. We created how, what? We wanted the S.O. society to be. We created what we wanted the society to be during that period that you're talking
about. We created a new direction. We created an alternative. We created an alternative to the existing institutions. When we created the free medical clinics, that was an alternative to the hospitals and to the HMOs. When we created the free medical clinics, we created an alternative to the retailers and who were holding surplus foods that people needed. When we created economic programs, we created an alternative to people who were paying who being underpaid. Okay, when we created our educational school, the Oakland Community School, we created an alternative to an institution that undereducated or miseducated people. So we created something that didn't exist. We created a bubble. We created something that we could pull people around and into.
W-O, and it worked. And it worked.
It had its successes, but we also had our faults and failures.
But because it worked. It TH threatened the power structure.
Oh, no doubt.
Anytime, again, the operative word is threatened, but again, there's a law in physics says that no two bodies can exist in the same place at the same time. That's a law of physics. You cannot have a capitalist program, a capitalist operation, a capitalist society, and a socialist society existing in the same place at the same time. One has to be superior to the other. Huey, that those were his ideas that he had learned through time and passed on to members of the Black Panther Party. So those two ideas could not exist. What the Black Panther Party was doing and what was existing under the guidance of the United States government and its agencies, they could not exist. There was a contradiction. There was a conflict. And that conflict was antagonistic. In order to subordinate the Black Panther Party, they had to resort to their agencies to undermine, neutralize, or terminate its membership or its programs.
May what? I say something? Oh, okay.
What? When? We? T? F? E? Fed? P? People? When we fed people, the? Q? The W? No, the Q?
The line, you mean.
U? The question was how, why did not the government feed people?
It was not in their interest. It was not in
well,
their
he's saying
interest.
The fact that, just the fact that we were feeding people
made that
question come up and made it clear.
Abundantly
why
clear.
Isn't the government doing this?
That's
if it's
right.
possible to do, why isn't the government
let me
doing
say something, Frank, just before you, I don't want to cut your thought, though, because the thought... Yeah, well, let me just say this. To what Steve is talking about we were free for a while... To give a different angle, but a more concrete. What we're talking about here is the dynamic, group dynamics. Mm. When people operate in a milieu where they have co-thinkers, it can create the understanding that the ideas that you have, you know, are growing exponentially. And the truth of the matter is, let's understand this, they actually took a survey in Black America, I believe it was in 1970, and this is like a Gallup type of poll, where they asked Black Americans, all right, look, who do you think best represents your interests, the NAACP or the Black Panther Party? And this was supposed to be an accurate poll. I don't know if any of them are accurate, but this poll actually was taken. 75% chose the NAACP, but 25% chose the Black Panthers. And this was at a time when we were being shot down, framed up, and every other kind of abomination. So how could you think? Well, because I think there's a great philosopher that once said, freedom is the recognition of necessity. And I believe at that time, we had a pretty good idea what we felt we needed to do. We were clear about that. And that kind of, you know, takes off your back a lot of the false consciousness that people absorb about why they, you know, like lying politicians. There's no reason to like lying politicians. Come on. But people go through this mental gymnastics and nonsense and masturbation to find justifications for the most bizarre social activity, you know, like supporting your enemy class in an election.
Frank,
what for? What are you going to get out of that?
Frank, at one point, Huey said, there is a conception that will grow within you. Its name shall be called freedom. The conception, the concept, that's what grew in all of us. We had that concept, the idea, okay, the belief, the attitude that we were free. And what we did, we were free from all the obstacles of the social paradigms that existed then. Mm-hmm. So within and overleaping those, that concept, that made us free. That concept gave us our freedom.
And we S-E set up A L alternative.
That was the biggest thing, to set up an actual organizational alternative so people could see that we, the works that we were actually doing, like the breakfast program. I think a lot of people don't know this. Black Panthers tested 1 million Black people in America for sickle cell anemia, for instance. A disease that many people didn't even know exists, let alone know that there were specific evolutionary and...
Why do you keep saying the Black Panther Party?
Well, that's true, though.
Members were the Black Panthers.
Okay. Okay, but I mean, well, okay. But the point I'm making is, this was a project that we had. I was very proud of that, actually. Because I learned a lot through that process, and I thought we did good. Such a small organization to fill such an important basic need. And it did expose the government. In Oakland, they set up a free breakfast program for the children, didn't they, Steve?
Not only, it began in Oakland, then spread through all of the campuses.
I'm talking about the government felt compelled to do it.
Through the school system.
That's right.
They had to. They had to because they had to. They didn't feel it because the immediate need was there. The need was there. And the focus was there. If these little shoestring budget, radical, militant, so-called revolutionaries, if they can do it, why can't this huge federal government, the most powerful government in the country, in the land of free, why can't they do it? They had to. They were so embarrassed and threatened. They were embarrassed and threatened. They had to react and respond.
That goes on today, by the way, folks. Still today, in the city of Oakland, children get diapers at school. And I love it.
And?
That's a legacy of the Black Panthers.
We? S-E set up C-L-I clinics and W and S C school and schools.
Yes. See. Now, wait. What you're saying, Frank, though, could you be, I'm sorry, let me just say, you were active in another area than the Bay Area when you were younger. Isn't that correct?
I-W-I-S-T started in San Bernardino.
Where's that, though? It's down south from here, right?
Yes, it's below, it's, yes.
And that was, so what you're talking about is the kind of the influence that the programs and leadership of the Black Panther Party had on other radicalized elements outside of their own ranks. Is that not right?
Where the R A radical were F R F E E, few, where the radicals were few, but the B, L, the Black Panther, no, the Black, S, the Blacks, were P, Panthers, and the Whites were SDS.
Okay, Frank. Remember now, the one thing that separated the differences here, you had the white mother country radicals, as Eldridge called them, okay, Weathermen, SDS, other groups that came out, and you had the Black Panther Party. Okay, the difference was, as Huey defined it, is a big difference between being revolutionary, radical, or militant. The revolutionary brings the masses with them because they follow and lead. The radical movement, those who were out there acting on their own, they didn't bring the white communities with them. They didn't draw the support. The Weathermen, SDS, they didn't bring the white communities with them. They didn't bring the poor whites with them. They had to get into the communities to mobilize. That's when they brought people with them. The Black Panther Party, through their programs, it nurtured the needs and interests of people. That's when people supported the Black Panther Party. It wasn't Huey, it wasn't Bobby, it wasn't David, it wasn't Eldridge. It was those programs that nurtured, it brought people along. Yes. So those were the things. That was the difference there. That moving, you pull people along. As George said, you have to embrace and pull in order to enrich your people.
Just real quick, also just to add to that, because there for young people that don't know much about this history, there is an excellent film called Protest in Berkeley in the 60s or something of that order. Mm-hmm. It's at most libraries, and it's worth seeing. Because what they situated in, and I thought was worthy, was a lot of white kids joined the civil rights movement as SNCC and CORE began to actually come to the cities to recruit people to go work in the South. And that's some of the, I mean, in America, that was some of the first political experience a young person could have. Because this is right on the heels of the McCarthy period. When anything you did, any question you had, you a communist, or you was a communist, and all that old nonsense. Then, those same people, that's who became SDS. And while I think Steve is unfortunately correct to point out that we didn't get a lot of support from the poor white workers, that's who became basically like the Reagan Democrats later on, so to speak. In reality, though, there was a pretty huge anti-war movement, though. And I think that women's movement grew to millions. So, you know, it wasn't as successful amongst the working class people. And, but they had some, you know, they had a base of support later on. Not in the 60s, but later on, late 60s.
But I think the Black Panther Party was still the spontaneous factor. It was the factor that led to the understanding that people could leapfrog into other regions. It led to that. It gave some direction. See what Frank's up to. See what Frank's up to.
He said, and Frank said, and when I moved to Santa Fe,
Santa Fe,
New Mexico.
New Mexico, yeah. Oh shit, Santa Fe's nice.
The C H Chicanos U S used the B Black Panthers M O model to
organize their movement.
Yes.
That's quite true. Yes.
Because there were numbers, though. You had the Brown Berets.
That's right.
Then you had the Young Lords on one side.
That's New York and Chicago.
And then there were another number of unknown small groups, but they organized communally, though. Even though they get the attention, the Black Panther Party was able to recognize them, and they gained support in their community. That was the important part. They had community support. It wasn't one, two, or three people doing something. They had established programs there. They met the interests. They met the needs of the people there around them and reached out into the rural areas, not only in New Mexico, but in Arizona, okay, in parts of Texas, which led to some of the People's Party number 2, which eventually became chapters and branches of the Black Panther Party, and the other solidarity committees also. But people were picking up on the program, not on the personalities of Huey and Bobby or other members of the Black Panther Party. They were picking up on issues of survival, and those ideas came from the party, and all they did was gain the consciousness and interpret it in their own manner. And that, you know, Huey had already said that power was the ability to define and identify phenomena and make an act in the desired manner. And this is what was happening in those communities.
All of W H I, which all of which were T H threatening. All of which were threatening.
Just a couple of points about, though, this legacy of literature that exists about the Panthers. Because since we're going to talk about, you know, McCutcheon's book, let's talk just briefly about other books that have been written. So people, when you want to grab a book and grab some education, you have some sense of where to start and what you might do. Because there is really an interesting legacy. I don't know where to really start. I brought a few pieces because I thought that there has been some confusion, you know? Yeah, there has.
So let me see if I can start in the beginning. First of all, if you want to know about a subject, it's not a bad idea to use documentary information.
So documentary information, what are we talking about? We're talking about a book like The Black Panthers Speak by Philip Foner. That book is available. Amazon, any, you can get that book if you wish. And people, don't fake. You say, oh, the man's crazy. What are you showing me all these books for? Well, because we want you to learn. You're not going to learn in an hour and a half. You're going to learn about Steve. You're going to learn about his contribution. But we want to give you some context in which Steve's book comes. This is the book, The Black Panther Speak. And it's what's so nice about it is that they include a pretty, it's an overview of what the Panthers were about, what the Panthers did from their own words, from our own words. And I thought it was very nice. So I recommend this as a starting point, right? Oops, look at me. That's the actual old cover. As a starting point, that documentary, that's a good start. Now, Huey Newton wrote a book called To Die for the People, which had some of his earliest pronouncements, and things that he wrote and motions that were passed inside of the Panthers, which included things like In Defense of Self-Defense. Very important book. Argument that needed to be made and defended. In Defense of Self-Defense. Now, he also has his... Steve pointed out to me an important contribution called Revolutionary Suicide. Now that's out the horse's mouth. That's his philosophy, intercommunalism. Revolutionary intercommunalism. But that's an important spot to look at. Now, go ahead.
What does that mean?
At the point when Huey analyzed, made the examination of the philosophy of the Black Panther Party, he said that, well, socialism cannot exist in the world because there are no nations in the world. He said the world has become so technologically integrated that the technology has infiltrated the world, so all the boundaries have been broached. So economically and technologically. So what we have are no longer nations, we have territories. Some of those territories have been liberated. At the time, People's Republic of China, Cuba, the Vietnam Republic, the Korean Republic, etc., etc., etc. But Huey talked about communities that have been liberated. And he said that since there were no longer nations, that we have a worldwide system of communities. Some are liberated, others are still under siege, still developing. He said at that point we have what we call reactionary intercommunalism. Mm-hmm. The ones that had holding their own, like the People's Republic of China, Cuba, have to wait until the other territories liberate themselves. He said once all the other territories in the world liberate themselves, then we reach that stage of revolutionary intercommunalism, where there are no political boundaries, no social boundaries, but people still have their differences because of the social baggage that we carry. He said once those boundaries have been passed, and we all come beyond, grow beyond those social stages, grow beyond those political stages, that is what we're talking about in terms of a communist world. And the idiots who talk about communist states today have no idea of what Marx, Lenin, or Hegel, Engels, anybody was talking about. They have no idea. There's no such thing as a communist state. They are communist parties. But Huey made it plain. We started, the world started with communal societies. It will progress to intercommunal societies and then eventually break down these burdens. Not in my lifetime. But theoretically, if the world progresses that much, if people are willing to progress that much. That was the concept, the philosophy of revolutionary intercommunalism.
Mm-hmm. E-W-E, mm-hmm. We. Well, mm. It mm. May mm. O over, it may OC occur. F A fast, faster than he, than you think, because of no M O more O I no more oil S. So, we will be forced to be CO communities because of the less ability to travel
distances. And
there's a
negative. Oh, I read you. Yeah. I read you. Not only that, because of the collapse of society that will ensue, because our whole society is based on an oil economy, an oil automobile type. But that's it. That's what their economics are based on.
Or.
And that's not good.
Or a S or a L A L T E. Alternative to oil,
excuse me.
But S T I still C E N centered, centralized, but an alternative to oil, but still centralized in. They are S E A searching for that.
Yeah, they're searching for how to centralize it. But we already know there's sunlight. There's things that they can't own. And so this is going to be interesting. Let's just say that. Let me just finish this one point off about these books, these godforsaken books, and then. I think we might want to get in some detail about Steve's piece, because I think it's very interesting. Here you go, The Deacons for Self-Defense. Very important little episode in history. Most people know nothing of it. But it was The Deacons for Self-Defense, along with Robert Williams and his black militia, that inspired Huey in the first place. Huey read the book, Negroes with Guns, by Robert Williams. I strongly recommend that people acquaint themselves. There is some actual literature that that's relevant to this whole enterprise of black liberation.
There is a movie that people can watch. Yes, isn't it called The Deacons?
They have one on The Deacons for Self.
Deacons for the Event.
Deacons for Defense, and then there is also somebody made a film about the life of Robert Williams. It was played on Channel 9. Now, the movie on this is called a docu, not a documentary. What do you call when you act in a
docudrama?
Docudrama. And Whitaker. Forrest Whitaker plays.
HBO?
Yeah,
that
no.
That was in
the
Deacons
for Showtime.
Defense.
It was Showtime.
Yep, Deacons for Defense.
It was Showtime.
Yeah. That was mm-hmm.
And then Robert Williams was on some program produced on Channel 9. And it's just about the life of Robert Williams, the man that wrote Negroes with Guns, and very, very interesting stuff. By the way, I found it. I'm a little slow. Mm. That's the book.
That's the first one.
To Die for the People, with the early writings of Huey Newton. Huey Newton is unfortunately underrated as a theoretician because he didn't finish his PhD until...
In the 80s, huh?
1978.
Okay.
But he basically was a very bright man. And the early stuff he wrote, you know, We always learn to look at people not as a snapshot, but somebody that's in a process of their life. And at his high points, he actually wrote some insightful material. Many people have heard of this one, Seize the Time. Very readable. I think I read this book in 2 days at the time, because Bobby Seale wrote it while he was in prison.
In New Haven.
And so this came out while the stuff was kind of going on. So it's kind of, and it's got that kind of read to it. I think it's a very necessary part of understanding the history of the Panthers. Then there is I'll get to that later. Just one more thing. Dr. Newton, Dr. Huey P. Newton's doctoral thesis, The War Against the Panthers, very concrete, talks about some of the things that they did, the state did to the Panthers in the name of national security. People should be familiar with that. And I'm trying to find that ugly book. That nasty. Yeah. Oh, here it go. Now this book represents a kind of almost an attempt by the ruling class to be smudged, to sully, to muddy the waters of Black Panther history. It's a horrible book, and just warning, no, it is not worth reading. So if you see it, get it at your own risk. I read it because I didn't know what it was about. I really didn't. And what this was about was this Negro, and there are such Negroes on this earth. You've heard of Clarence Thomas, for instance, who wanted to make it in the literary world. And the best that this individual could come up, I don't want to be calling him a bunch of dirty names, could come up with was to write this lying, this sensationalist, but lying thing about the crazy stuff. Panthers were working with Castro to sell crack. I mean, bad. When we found out, actually, who was it that brought the crack? CIA. All day. So, just lied. Vicious lies about the Panthers. This book, is not too far from it. More modern, not too far from it. Murder in Model Cities was about one of the low points in Panther history where a police agent convinced some Panthers that another innocent fellow, Alex Rackley, was a policeman. George Sams, I think his name was. This was ugly. And the brother wound up, getting killed because people was not feeling good about this police infiltration and provocation. And then, people were so distraught afterwards as they found out what happened. I think something like 12 people confessed. Really, that's how bad people felt about it. A real catastrophe. They tried to lock Bobby Seale up on this case. So he's in here too. So
14 members from New Haven were arrested in that case.
Desmond. So, I'm just not a recommendation, but we can't just show you one side even of the worst arguments available. So what this led to was a revival. This lying document led to a revival among Black Panthers to produce and control our own history. And this was the first
academic work,
but that really came out as a response to that shadow of the Panther piece. And we said, no, you can't be doing that. And my man, Charles Jones, the editor of this piece, got all of the living Panthers that he could, write, and got them to do a piece about, so it's a compilation of things written by Panthers about the Panther experience. Now, in fact, Steve has got a piece in here, a piece from his diary is in here. So Steve's been doing it for a while, folks. Now, he wasn't the only one, all right? He did it, once he did it, Kathleen Cleaver made the following contribution. It is entitled Liberation, Imagination, and the Black Panther Party.
Denny Lane.
She actually
Well, Elaine, yeah. Actually, Elaine, but Elaine was more the biography, right? But see, this book was more, because this is a compilation of some of the most interesting, just very good stuff. Stuff you wouldn't normally get to see is more a continuation of this. Okay? Now, in terms of biographies, we talked about Revolutionary Suicide. Okay, Taste of Power, Lane Brown. There's several. I mean, look, this is Big Man, Panther on the Prowl, by Ebert Big Man Howard. All right? And, you know, that's his. I think it's useful that people come out with their own understanding of the experience that they went through. This here, The House That Herman Built. We're talking about Herman Wallace, and we're talking about, this is the Angola 3. This guy has been in solitary confinement in Angola, 25 years?
28 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, solitary confinement. They did some interesting stuff. They joined the Panthers in prison. They said, we like this. Joined the in prison and started a movement against rape amongst the prisoners. And prevailed. Eventually, their influence made the authorities so uncomfortable, they just put them in solitary confinement. Upstanding, fabulous human beings. Here's another. Okay. This brother just died. William Lee Brent. Long time gone. This is the guy that hijacked the jet when they mistakenly thought he had robbed the liquor store. The Panther leadership didn't know what to think. This is the truth. I got to tell this one part here. He go run up to the door to buy some gum or something, and he got his piece in his pants. So the guy looked, see that piece. He said, "Man, give me a bubble." He said, "Dude, just start emptying the cash register." Next thing you know, he robs. He ain't robbed nothing, but the dude did see the gun, right? In panic, so he went. He didn't know what to do. And he hijacked the plane and went to Cuba. I don't want to say any more. Unfortunately, brother just passed away. Interesting reading, though. This is along the lines of the, you know, individual, the various, biographies. Asada, now a classic, about her experience in the Black Panthers and after, including her escape from American prisons, and now she is in Cuba. Her aunt, Evelyn, friend of mine, wonderful, who defended a lot of Panthers in New York City. She worked at New York University, NYU. And of course, then, we have Mumia Abdul-Jamal. His book, and this one here, I don't care what nobody says. You might just borrow it if you can't buy it.
New one.
But this is, yes, this is relatively new. And I think Mumia, the beauty of the book is his style and his intellectual curiosity leads him in directions that are not limited to his subjective experience. So he thinks a little more out loud. He goes down roads that a lot of people don't venture when they do biographies. So he has a chapter in here just, for instance, on women in the Panthers. People like to attack the Panthers and say, you guys was male chauvinists. Well, people's attitudes may not have been perfect. I hurry up except that. But people need to know that when all the men got arrested, who do you think ran the organization? The women literally ran the organization in many situations because they were the only ones available. Very excellent reading. And I guess last but not least, it's called Target Zero, and Miss Cleaver came out with Kathleen Cleaver, kind of produced it. These are the kind of like, it's a compilation of the best of Elvis Cleaver's writings when he was, you know, of a revolutionary mind.
Do S O Do So Why No Do So No Do? No. So. Why? Do. Every. One. USA. Say, why does everyone say Eldridge? Why does everyone say E? X, Black Panther.
Go ahead.
Only ones who consider themselves ex-Black Panthers are the ones who left with bad feelings, bad attitude towards their experience in the party. Party members who left because they felt they had nothing more to give, or they had nothing more they wanted to offer the organization, or they had to leave because they had problems with the organization, they left on their own, but they still consider themselves Panthers. The ones who left because they knew they had violated party policy, party rules, they had disrespected all of the protocol that the Black Panther Party stood for and was trying to present to the community, those people not only disrespected themselves, they disrespected the Black Panther Party, they disrespected black and poor people. They consider themselves ex-Panthers. Not only that, but because they were in collusion with the forces of oppression, the police agencies that tried to undermine the Black Panther Party and the black community. Those are ex-Panthers. So if you hear someone calling themselves an ex-Panther, more than likely they were up to something nefarious in the first place.
Oh, Steve, you show his code. That's the explanation. But I would just, as a person that used to be a neophyte for Eldridge Cleaver, because I was taken in, okay? I really feel that his situation was a little bizarre. Left the country in 1968 under threat of arrest. Because you might recall history, what happened. The night that Martin Luther King got killed, brothers took a ride. People were angry, and they were armed. And there was a confrontation with the Oakland police. And in that confrontation, that's when the young man got killed.
Bobby Hutton.
That's right. Brother Bobby Hutton. And Eldridge was there. Now, Eldridge, see, people like to put him down for this, and I think it's ridiculous. I just think he understood reality. Having been in the prisons for years, Eldridge knew the treachery and the physical cruelty of these police. He knew what they were capable of. So he took his clothes off and came. They said he took his clothes off and came out there. Little Bobby didn't quite want to. He wasn't with that. You know, taking your clothes off in public. But you go to prison, you know how the thing works. So that's when little Bobby got killed that night. Now, I say all of that to say that Eldridge then left the country in exile. Wound up in Algeria. We were trying to have an international Panther fraction operate out of Algeria. And things went crazy. We now know, and it don't matter whether you like Bobby or Eldridge or this one or that one, we now know for a fact that the government sent letters to various leaders in the Panthers. There's no question about this. In 1975, when they broke in and stole the FBI files, I'm talking about.
Well, those letters started going back and forth during the late 69 and 70.
Yes, that's right. But I'm saying how we know. I'm not some old, decrepit, crazy black man that done went paranoid and lost my mind. I'm telling you, this is a fact. Ward Churchill has written a couple of very excellent books about what he calls COINTELPRO, which is the code name for the counterintelligence program of the FBI. That's what's real. They sent letters saying, Steve, Gerald said he gonna kill you. And they sent Gerald letters saying, Gerald, Steve done robbed you and took your money and say he about to finish you up. And get mutual suspicion going between people. Manipulate people's personal relationships in a very negative way. And which led to flare-ups. Because a lack of experience, people never thought that, whoa, somebody might have, you know, so of course we learned something from this. Now, what do? You get that letter, what do? You take that letter to the, Steve, is this your shit? What's up with you? You try to clear the air. At that time, that's not what happened. Unfortunately, not the way it worked out.
Well, but what happened, it led to a lot of paranoia. Especially among, at the Central Committee level, particularly with Huey being newly released he was suspicious of other Central Committee members and leadership around the party at the time. Eldridge, being in Algeria, was suspicious of Huey and people who were around him. Those things which led to what was happening in New York. In New York, people don't know that never truly came under the Central Committee leadership, because they came, they were nationalists in the first place. Most of the leadership that came under the Black Panther Party in New York was nationalists. So they never really adhered to the decisions of the Central Committee. So when things went military with the Central under Eldridge's guidance, Eldridge talking about revolution in our lifetime. Huey said, survival pending revolution.
Right.
That was a contradiction right there.
Yeah, there were political differences.
New York State and New Jersey adhered to the ideas, the concepts of Eldridge, which did not come have the assent, have the consent of the Central Committee of the Black Panther Party. Huey went along with that because of Eldridge's presence, his prestige, his image. But behind closed doors, they discussed this. They argued about it.
Huey argued
with David and other members of the Central Committee who disagreed with Huey's position. Huey's position, we have to move the masses. Eldridge's position was that we have to do this now. That is what happened. That's what caused a defection in the party. Eldridge defected from the party. There was no split in the party. Eldridge and branches in New York and New Jersey defected from the party. They were gone. Hey, you couldn't take it. You cut something off so the rest of the body can heal. That was it.
Okay.
There was no split. There was a defection. Eldridge and those who had that attitude. Had that attitude, they defected with Eldridge. One, because they never really understood the Black Panther Party, the ideas, the ideology and philosophy of the Black Panther Party in the first place. They came in with an agenda and never accepted the Black Panther Party as it was supposed to be. They never accepted the vision of the Black Panther Party.
Wait a minute.
And the F?
Yeah, wait a minute.
The FBI?
Wait a minute.
And the FBI.
Well, we didn't talk about the FBI. Wait a minute. Huey Newton doesn't come back alive and y'all don't even know it.
Played on it. And the FBI played on
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Can I just say something before the FBI played on it? All right, now everybody in the house know. Everybody know. And you're going to know more when we get to talk about the book, which we're going to hurry up and do that. This one here is from Baltimore and wound up in Oakland. I'm from New York, so he's talking about my stuff, all right? And he's right. There certainly were serious political differences. No question about that. But one thing that was absolutely wrong that he said. Hold on, Frank. Let me just say this.
O-I-S-T-E stepped in
shit.
Shit.
Well, no.
When
I think
I said,
"No, you opened Pandora's box."
You were FR from New York. Oh,
no,
when Frank said that you were from New York, he stepped in shit.
Yeah, maybe.
I wasn't going to let that go.
Now you all know, for sure. He's not really, now, and I am. So I just want to say this one little thing and then move on. And that is that most of what the brother said was all true, I think. Except there was no discussion. And that's where the negative role that COINTELPRO played. There was not a discussion, Steve.
Yeah.
There was not. And in fact, the first time they discussed it publicly, Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton, was that infamous phone call that was on. All right,
that was it.
Well,
that
they didn't even say that.
Everything else was behind. Everything else
was
Central Committee.
But there wasn't enough. Yes, that's
but
true.
That was need to know. It was need to know. You didn't need to know that to function in Illinois. You didn't need to know that in Southern California, Winston-Salem.
That there was really no upfront discussion.
General body, all we had to know.
That somebody manipulated that stuff and put Huey Newton calling in to Eldridge Cleaver, on live television. And then they start talking about the split on air. And I'm looking, I'm...
No, Huey...
We did?
Huey told Eldridge that... No, Eldridge told Huey that he was expelled from the party. And Huey told... On air. No, no, this was on air. This was on air. And Huey explained on air, I am the Minister of Defense. You are the Minister of Information. You are in exile, and you weren't supposed to leave the country without party permission in the first place. You have defected from the party. That's what Huey said.
There was mutual accusation. Yeah.
That's
what
Huey said.
But you know what, Steve?
But Huey had the back.
Don't serve you so well on the dynamics of that discussion.
Huey had the backing of the Central Committee. That is what matters.
Yeah, Huey had the backing. No. Steve.
He had the backing of the Central Committee.
How about the truth?
That is the truth.
Does the truth matter?
The truth is Huey had the backing of the Central Committee.
That is true. That he had the backing. That does not, but that your discussion of who said what and all of that is incomplete.
It's Huey and
Eldridge. Where is that?
It's Huey and Eldridge.
See, just tell us, because we're here to educate.
That was a transatlantic phone call.
Yeah, but where's that transcript for that phone call?
I don't have it.
I've read it.
And you say that to say what?
To say that always I invite people that are, you know, enthusiastic about these matters that want to scratch and find the truth. Just look it up. Because it was really a discussion on the phone and somebody wrote it down. And you will see that there's a little bit more to it.
The point is the Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party does not owe anything to the Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. Minister of Information, who is in exile, who was brought into the Black Panther Party, who didn't perform his duties while he was here. He was brought in for public relations. He was brought in for his oratorical performances. Yes. But he did not, and he did not have online responsibility in the party.
This debate.
Huey, Bobby, and David had in what? Line responsibility. Huey
should
never gave Eldridge
have
online
happened.
Responsibility in the party, online authority.
Frank said this debate is what should have happened then.
Sure should have. Because what actually happened...
That was 1971.
Wait a minute, Steve. And this is the part... See, Steve's right. We were expelled in New York. The whole state was expelled.
Except for Corona. Queens.
Oh, okay. And
Queens,
that's where...
Queens State.
That's where Napier was.
That's where Sam
and
was.
And this is where it gets
Sam
ugly. Because Sam got killed, and then somebody else from another faction got killed. But what that did was create an atmosphere. Most of the people that were in the Panthers at that moment voted with their feet, and I'll never forget it. Because they ridiculed me for staying. I ain't stayed too long, I'll say. You know, like Steve would be considered more like a lifer. And I was kind of drafted. Look at it that way. Okay? But the point I want to get at is that, you know, this was, I mean, people quit in droves when the stuff about the shooting of one Panther by another came out. Because people wasn't with that. They wasn't with that. They didn't think that was cool. To this day, I don't think it's cool, but I understand it. And that's what we're trying to achieve here, some understanding, historical understanding.
Because it PLA played in to the TRA trap. It played into the trap.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. But Steve, tell us now, for instance, like a lot of people don't know this, they were so hard on the Panthers out the gate. Steve, didn't you? They locked your ass up before you even got over here.
Yeah.
This is in the book. I remember this from being in the book. Go ahead, Steve. Okay. Share that with us. And how they framed you up and all, just briefly.
There were threats not only against Baltimore. Baltimore, we were actually under the radar in terms of what the federal government was interested in. But because we were in Maryland, yet and later on when we found out Fort Meade, Fort Halliburton, mm-hmm. all of the institutions that had been doing military medical testing, psychological testing, and recruiting grounds for a lot of the central people who infiltrated not only the Black Panther Party but other government and pro people agencies and pro peace, anything pro people. It was coming out of Maryland, and we're sitting right there, didn't have a clue. We didn't have a clue. But the things that happened in Baltimore, we had two major cases. One was a case we were charged with murdering informant. Who? The FBI arrested me. I said, who? I don't know who you're talking about. Next, we find out Eddie Conway, one of our early comrades, he's charged with a murder of a police. Policeman in Baltimore.
Eddie is
so
still in prison.
All this. So these two, in the case that involved me and 18 other members of the Black Panther Party, was supposed to have happened in 1969, and they waited until 1970 to arrest us, trying to raid our office. 5 days later, they had already arrested Eddie and two other members of the Black Panther Party for a police murder. No one found a weapon. No one saw any shooting, anything. But Eddie's been in prison since April of 1970.
That's right.
Jackie, who was on the case with him, Jackie Powell, James Jackie Powell, died while he was in prison. Eddie's comrade on that case, J.J. James Johnson, he's still on that case also. But the governor of Maryland would not issue, he is not going to parole a lifer. So Eddie is serving life.
Innocent man.
And that was supposed to have divided the community in Baltimore against the Black Panther Party. No, the media and the political structure tried to divide the community against the Black Panther Party, but the community is held tight in support of not only Eddie Conway, but the Black Panther Party and what we did in the 4 years that we did exist there in Baltimore.
Is one of my PLAN planks is to open all the FIL files on the WA war A against the PE people.
I'm for it. I'm for it, and we might as well just say that that implies repealing the Patriot Act.
Yes.
But Steve, go on, tell us a little more. Now, that was Eddie. All right, Steve, if you want people to read the book, and that's why, but Steve actually got locked up too, and that's with the 18 other Panthers. But y'all beat that case, obviously.
Right.
Okay.
Everyone.
See,
so
understand it. The Panthers did not lose all of the cases. Understand that. It's really important because they tried to frame up damn near everybody. But the Panthers did not lose all of the cases. In Steve's case, that's one example of a victory. And there were actually many such victories because the state, the racist state, was so careless and silly. And, you know, they didn't even bother to build a case. They just said, we just locked these black people up because we think they're dangerous, and that's the end of that. We don't need no proof.
In our
and that didn't
case,
work. In people were, you know, finding them innocent.
People.
Isn't that true?
Think. Well, people think. No. People think the 60s did not, W-O, didn't work. But the REA reality is there was a war, a war, to M-A, make it F-A, fail. Like I W E, I went to the U N University W without walls in Berkeley in the 70s. The FBI, you should tell it. The FBI, FIFO, forced the university to close, or they would CH. A charge them charge two of their D S E second S E C R secretaries two of their secretaries of F R A fraud for but no the S E secretaries were F R from the from S O S O U South A America that is the L the K kind of S H, the kind of shit that happened to fight against the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Then,
common.
Then, at the on the college campuses, not only in the neighborhoods, in the communities, it was everywhere. It was, believe it or not, the college campuses were more accessible for infiltration than even in the organizations. The college campuses, the college student unions, classes were more infiltrated, especially in Berkeley, than were some of the organizations. And people didn't even know it. They were sitting side by side with people in journalism classes, in broadcasting classes, in language classes, who eventually went on to join organizations that worked on behalf of the United States government or their agencies. And the ones who were sitting beside them didn't even know it. Didn't even know it. But no one wants to confess to this. Especially at schools like UC Berkeley, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown. These schools here, they've been turning out operatives for the Defense Department and the State Department for generations. And no one wants to do the work. No one wants to fess up that the United States government has been doing this all along, recruiting specifically for this. And they are doing it now. When you look at the number of students who are getting accepted into different universities and particular programs, you look at their majors, you look at the recruiting grounds of where the job opportunities are, They're going into private business, and private business is funneled right into the industries, funneled right through the consular operations department, State Department, State Department is nothing but a synonym for the S, for the CIA. And people do not believe what is happening. I'm going into government. I'm going to make a change. I'm going into international relations. I am going to make a change. You're going in deaf, dumb, and blind because they do not have an understanding of social policy, and they do not understand the links between the government, what is, and what is the fact. It's too bad people have been blind so long, and so many people have died and have suffered behind it. And I have no sympathy for them. I have no sympathy at all.
We, then, they, S, A, they say, S, E, C, the 60s didn't work.
Yeah, well, unfortunately.
Why? Why T? Why R? No, T R. Why try? The 60s didn't work. Why try?
Well, we're gonna have to look a little deeper than that, because I'm sure people say stuff like that. But the 60s was a period. There were many competing programs going on at the same time. You see, it wasn't like one thing happening. Many competing programs were in operation at one time. Not just the Black Panthers. You know, and I think people have to understand that some of these programs and these policies were in opposition to each other. Sure. Unfortunately, there was a certain amount of violence between groups that claimed to be liberatory. Upon some, I'm sorry. I mean, that's just the way, you know. We have to be able to, you know, step back and see that. But Steve, you was going to tell us a little bit more about your book, particularly why did you write your book, for instance?
Oh, okay.
Why did you put your effort into writing 400 pages and then editing and all of that? Mm-hmm. What's the reason? Why?
Okay. Well, one, it didn't begin as a book. It was a journal collected from letters. My mother happened to save these letters. She had two shoeboxes of letters that she had saved, and when I went back when my mother passed in 1986, and we were cleaning out things, so I pulled these shoeboxes out. There were letters that had been passed back and forth that I had sent her and my brother, and she had kept them. Some she hadn't even shown to my brother. Some she hadn't shown to my dad, and she had kept those letters. Plus, I had journals of things I've written since I had already been writing for the newspaper on and off during the years, either writing when I was in Baltimore or as a sports writer or columnist while I was out here, then writing my poetry, so my mom had things on hand. So I just brought those out with me. Later on, a few years later, Charles Jones contacted me when he was working on his book, which is now the Black Panther Party Reconsidered.
Right.
And he asked me, did I have anything written? I said, well, I just started to put some letters together basically for my kids. So my kids would have a record of what I did, because we had been talking about that different things. Mm-hmm. So I would have something to pass on to them. So I gave Charles one of the chapters that I had written from 69 up through 1970. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, this is not a diary. This is just things that I put together from my journals and recollections. So he published it in his book, The Black Panther Party Reconsidered. And I told him I had the rest of it. He said, how much do you have? I said, I have all the way up until the last day that I was a member of the party. Mm-hmm. I have notes from the last day, either through letters or what I had, notes that I have written to pass on in case I did not make it. There would be a record. So after that, after Charles's work was printed in 1998, I just kept adding on to what I had, trying to expand it. I'll get this together for my kids. And I talked with our former communications secretary from Baltimore, Connie Felder, and because she was my significant other back then, and she said, you need to tell it in your story.
Oh.
I didn't want to do that,
oh.
though.
Oh.
But I didn't want to tell it in my words. I wanted other comrades to participate. Because the idea was to set it up so that 12 different comrades from across the geographical areas would all bring their work together. But they didn't get back to me. So when I found out I had a contract, after I kept writing around, and I got a contract, said, we want your work. Send us an introduction. They took the first three chapters. We don't want anybody else's words. We want your words. So I said, well, send a contract. They sent it. And I had to take over 400 pages, chop it up, put it in chapters, put titles on it, add what I wanted, throw out what I couldn't get in there. I had 3 months to do what I've been working on all those years. And I got it there 2 days ahead of my deadline.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, they said, it wasn't something that I wanted booked for me. Mm-hmm. It's something I wanted to pass on.
Well, you know, just one other thing I want to make sure we, because Steve and I were talking about the book, His Life. And one of the things, you know, he's very polemical now, so he's gonna say, well, some people think the Black Panther Party didn't exist from 66 till 1970 or 71. Well, see, I don't take that position, but I think those are the most important years of the Panther Party. I do, you know, we got different opinions, all right? But Steve actually provides information about what the Panthers were doing after 1972 that is not so well known. Because it wasn't driven by that image of the black people with the guns and the, you know, and that, and the leather coats and stuff. And the Panthers were trying other things. So for instance, he pointed out at the house that, Steve, just pop on in here whenever you're ready, mm-hmm. that they had ran for office in 1974 when Bobby Seale ran for mayor. And Lane Brown ran for city council. Bobby Seale got like 40% of the vote. Now, that's serious. I don't agree with that strategy because he ran as a Democrat. I'm being real honest, you know, I got to be clear. But there's no question that he had some influence to get 40% of the vote with no money. And then, because there wasn't no capitalist giving the Black Panthers money to run for office, believe that at least. But then, what I thought was also quite significant, you know, is that a number of the Panthers, like Steve, won in these local elections and were on the board of things like model cities, which they resigned from as soon as they sniffed the corruption that was going on. I thought that was significant, you know, that they won an election, went, occupied the seats that they won. And when they saw that there was absolute corruption going on, the money was being stolen and not, you know, doing any good to the masses, walked off, quit, resigned in protest. A little small thing in history that most people have no idea, because people really don't know much about Panther history. And one of the things that he does go over in this book is Panther history after 1972.
Right, let me start here. With Elaine running for political office. Elaine ran for the 3rd District City Council office again. This was 1975. Mm. To many outside of the party, it appeared that we were abandoning our fire and stances of the 60s. Elaine didn't make that decision in a vacuum. She talked with Huey and those among the central body about the efforts to mobilize her campaign. The media regarded her as a gentler side of the Panthers. Elaine was as fierce as any brother, and I had seen her demonstrate her demonstrate that at music festivals at the old Oakland Auditorium in 1973. The music group Graham Central Station and Ike and Tina Turner were scheduled to perform. Graham Central Station started the show, and then it was time for Ike and Tina Turner. Evidently, Ike didn't want to accept a check from the party for some reason. Comrades had been posted around the auditorium as monitors and security. When Ike and Tina refused to continue their performance, Huey arrived at the auditorium and kicked down Ike's door in the dressing room. Ike told Huey that he wasn't satisfied with the pay arrangements and that Tina would do one more song and no more. Tina finished her song and was about to leave the stage. Huey had instructed comrades that no one would leave until Ike and Tina honored their agreement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that was something
nobody
that was
knows
happening.
The story.
At the Oakland Community School, Donna Howe ran the Oakland Community School. Erica Huggins was the director, but Donna ran the school. Donna Howe had been designated as assistant director at OCS, and Carol Grandison, who had been a community worker, now Panther, with editorial skills, was pulled from the newspaper category to join the school staff as the curriculum director. Donna was always ready to get things set into motion. She took on her duties as though she had a written manuscript, visiting classrooms, filling in for teachers, and carrying out her administrative duties in conjunction with Erica. She was a whirlwind at the school. Donna had a biting tongue and didn't stand for anyone being slipshod in their tasks. She would criticize you at 10 a.m. and come back with praise for a comrade at 2 p.m.
And by the way, people should just be aware that the Oakland Community School that was set up by the Panthers was literally an award-winning effort and actually went on for a long time. It was one of the few areas where they couldn't even attempt to criticize what the Panthers were doing because their minds were so open and into the education that they performed well. They did really, really well. Steve, come on, give us one of them poems.
Okay, then.
Before you forget, man.
All right, here we go. On the contrary, there's this rumor that I am becoming obsolete, but I'm not like the dinosaurs that perished into history or the Model T that gave way in the face of advanced technology. There are stories told, insidious theories laid bare, that the black man is too dangerous to tolerate, and guardians of America think those decent folks looking over their shoulders at me as if I were wearing some sign that said he's a black man, beware. Oh, don't let me sound as though I'm complaining, whining, or don't appreciate. Not begging for sleight of hand concessions and refuse media-made primetime backwoods, but subtle kind of hate. My folks are made of that old school stuff. Here I am and I will stand tall enough. It has been written that any man can carry his load for a single day. I can and I will. We all will. Not even the threats of tormentors will deny our way. Those who see me as sport, like the buffalo, or for profit, as the African elephant, take heed. I will not be sacrificed, become some dusty antique. Beyond their graves, ancestors and I will have things to do about paths that can and still lead to freedom's day. There will be a place for me, even if I don't serve society's makers and creators of doublethink. Don't push this alley rat deeper into a corner. I'm already at the brink.
All right.
All right, now see, y'all don't know. The homeboy getting to his poetry now. That's a whole, at the end of every chapter of this fine book, Steve's got one of his poems.
M.
So,
O. more? Would you read another poem?
Sure.
Let's see. Let's get busy. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Frank, this is called On the Brink. Huey taught that dialectics of the universe was the ruling force, that all things flow and ebb, not as they appear or as chaos, some random choice. All things are positive and negative, strong and weak. If you have nothing in mind, a goal in sight, then by logic's right, you have nowhere to go and not a clue as to what you seek. Comrade Al Prentice Bunchy Carter said it best about folks who do not know what side of the room to sit, who could not find their own interest, let alone a direction to get. For Huey, Little Bobby, Sam Napier, Fred Hampton, for all those who couldn't and wouldn't and still can't find dreams and a hopes to fit, do something. Do something, goddammit, if you only spit. Mm-hmm. Panther Party was vanguard, a bold chapter in time, somewhere between improbable and whatever. Critics said we would set black folks back forever, but Huey and Bobby and Panther bleed like the Hungarian resistance. Nim, nim, so ha, no, no, never. Panther was not some accidental footnote, a dinner afterthought, or some Hollywood creation. We were not militant or radical, but the only revolutionary black organization to ever exist and grow inside this nation, and later recognized by other countries as our movement in search of a people's liberation. It wasn't Huey and Bobby who made Panther a new sensation. It was programmed for survival, that addressed old frustrations, lingering desperations. That was the engine of Panther's causation. It was not just guns that caught old racist J. Edgar Hoover's attention, but free food, free shoes, free health care, and a charter school that failed to make the 6 o'clock news. Instead, only received some grudging honorable mention. Panther was not a dare, but a response to U.S. policy that dug deep roots to organize and mobilize the community. Powers that be would not debate, did not hesitate. The government order was wipe out Panthers, clean them from America's plate. Those who attacked Panther, in effect, threaten you. To confront U.S. policy means that you're in their bullseye, too. They came in the mornings and at night, and when the dust and smoke cleared, enemies of the sun, oh shit, they knew they had been in the old school fight.
Wow.
See, now that's oh, man, I remember the first time I ever met him. He did one of them poems on a radio program. I think it was Slave Revolt Radio. I know a long time ago, I remember when I first met Steve. Well, Steve, tell us a little bit more, you know, give us a little... Look, here's what... How does a person that hears this and sees this program, this broadcast, how would they come about getting their hands on the book? Because, you know, there's something to be said about that.
Okay. Well, the book is available at BarnesandNoble.com. It's available at Barnes & Noble bookstores. If it's not in stock, then Barnes & Noble will order it.
Wait a minute, which one? There's a bunch of them. You talking about downtown Oakland or downtown
Downtown
Berkeley?
Oakland. Downtown Oakland.
Okay.
And since it's online, it'll be online at any of the Barnes & Noble
outlets. Okay.
Amazon.com has a number of vendors and a number of stores.
That have his book.
That have the book.
So you can get definitely online. You can hook up online, just Google, woo-woo, or go right to Amazon.
And you
if you're from the area, though, just go on downtown. The book is on the shelves.
And Amazon, they have more vendors than Barnes & Noble. And I think after the, well, that'll come up next. But Barnes & Noble was on the list to do a book presentation, book signing. But the next book signing that I have will be June 14th at the main library in Oakland. That'll be Saturday, June 14th.
Why don't we give people the location of the library?
Okay. The main library is 125 14th Street in Oakland.
Between Madison and what?
Madison and Oak.
Mm-hmm.
Madison and Oak. And
right off of 13th Street, is that?
It's right on 14th Street.
14th. Okay.
14th and Oak. And
can't miss it.
The
big
main
building.
Library. And that'll be Saturday, June 14th, the beginning of the Juneteenth weekend. Beginning of the Juneteenth weekend. And there'll be discussion. Hi. There'll be other former Panthers there.
That's right. He's not going to be the only crazy Panther there. There'll be a bunch of them.
But at the book signing and the discussion, I want to talk not so much as about what happened with me in Baltimore as how things started, but the changes that I went through, the process that I went through, mm-hmm. and I saw the Black Panther Party go through, and the changes that I saw happening in the world. Because as I grew, I learned that the emerging countries, the developing countries, were changing. So as they changed, as the party changed, I was growing also, taking steps at first. But I found that those steps, they became leaps. I was growing exponentially instead of arithmetically. So,
Are you S-T still? H-O, hopeful?
I believe that I believe more than I know.
Okay.
I believe more than I know.
Well, Steve, you hopeful. You know why I know you hopeful? Because Steve invests his entire life is around educating and dealing with and mentoring children. He works at an elementary school and is the coach of the chess team. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is a manifestation of hope. A lot of people talk, you know, I'm hopeful, but they don't do nothing.
Teach math during the day and coach chess after school.
Mm-hmm. And that's a sign of hopefulness as far as I'm concerned, because without the next generation ready to engage and carry out our hopes, it's pretty empty hope. You know, you got to do something about that hope.
But I say all that to say that what's in the book is not to give people an idea of hope, to buoy their dreams or whatever, but to give them the foundations that I had, the facts that I had, the opinions that I had, the beliefs that I had, and to show them that the steps that can be taken are already in place. People have to find their own place where to step, though. Step in the wrong place. Well, those things may not work for the individual, and that individual, even though it may be outspoken in the right direction, that the individual by himself, herself, is not going to change the world. It's just going to be one person whose name or vision is going to be blown up or ballooned. But I believe that the needs and interests of the people must, the masses of people, not only in Oakland, Berkeley, but across communities in this country, North America, South America, or the all the continents, those needs and interests somewhere, somehow, are going to be met organizationally in an organized manner. And Fidel said it best years ago when he was asked in a TV interview. He said, you want to give people anything that they ask for? He said, no, I believe people need what people should have what they need. And the interviewer asked him, what if they needed the moon? Mm-hmm. If they needed the moon, they should have it. Mm-hmm. People should not mm-hmm. need. People need not need. Mm-hmm. And that's...
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh. K. Okay. H, E, here, is, why, the here is how, C, R, A, crazy, I, here is how crazy I am, would, you, too, C, oh, come back and G R I grill me on my platform.
Oh, he wanna talk about, in other words, he has a platform where he's running for president, right, as a writing candidate. And, you know, God, Anna, are you going to get me on here?
P, no, O, P, P, U, R, P, U, put some H, E, A, put some heat. You under me. Put some heat under me.
Okay, Frank.
Not N O, not now.
You asked for an answer, and I'm trying to say, I'm always, perpetually for discovering facts that I'm not aware of, reading, studying, sharing information, all of that. I want to be careful because I'm not interested in, a pissing contest on somebody that I basically respect, but I don't agree with everything. We have to, needs to be done. We have to strengthen the culture of the working people in that regard, so people learn to think critically, to listen, and to understand that you can respect a human being and simultaneously have a difference of opinion with them over this or that area of thought. I got that. I got that real well. I don't look forward to it. If you are, I don't, you know. Because I know I it's so easy. You have to be disciplined. Because it's so easy to ad hominem arguments. You know, this stuff is programmed into you by the system. So I just would like to be real careful with something like that. Because, I don't know. You ever see how people's shit degenerates into a personal attack and all kinds of... I don't like that stuff, so I like to be very careful.
I.
And save my venom and hatred for people that deserve it.
T, R, I, T, R, U, I trust you. I trust you.
Well, that's good. That's good to know that. But it's still, what I said is also true. So, you know, I let Steve speak for himself on that. But I, you know.
I. I have, I need to be G.R. grilled.
I'm hearing you real clear. Real clear.
When have you H heard a P presidential candidate say that?
Well, it's much worse than that, my man. In fact, these presidential candidates, we were talking about in the beginning of the show, we were kind of just casually, I'm making me kind of sick, you know, this business with Obama and his preacher. That's sad. That's sad that he would allow anyone to kind of push on him and pressure him. And, you know, you don't remind me of, there's a part of a book I'm going to loan to a friend tomorrow called 1984. And the protagonist is in the interrogation process. And he does slip. See, in 1984, you ain't supposed to do the nookie-nookie with nobody. I ain't too worried about that with this generation because they'll lose that fight. But nonetheless, that was the thing in 1984. So homeboy, the protagonist, has slipped off and done the nookie-nookie. And he's you know, getting along with this young lady and all of that. And by applying pressure to him during the incarceration process and threatening to expose him to rats, I think it was, he denounced the young lady, if you recall. You know?
Yes.
I'm afraid that Mr. Obama has kind of fell into that pitiful caricature.
Yes.
And lacked the inner strength to just stand up and say, look, that's my preacher. God bless him. You don't like him, don't come to our church.
He,
you know, whatever,
is,
you know.
He is my ex preacher.
You know, right?
No, he's not your ex-preacher. You're saying that's what Obama's
saying.
Oh, yeah. He's my ex-preacher.
Oh, yeah, in order to what's the word, to assuage public opinion or whatever. That's sickening.
I think if you diminish a campaign to people's personal frailties and whatever, then you're never going to elect a president.
That's exactly it.
You're never going to elect a president.
Yes.
Or you're never going to elect an ideal president. And as long as people harp on that, then they diminish the role that particular individual is supposed to play. If you want to concentrate on what a person can bring to the table, what a person has to bring in terms of mobilizing the
electorate,
the resources that a government is supposed to provide for its people, then I'm interested in that. I'm not interested in all the infantile neurotics of who have nothing else better to do to be involved in sniffing up somebody's butt.
I tell you, just for those who out there that I don't know when you're going to get this recording, but there is microfiche, and you can always go to the library for that. You won't be able to get it online, but I read the New York Times online, and a guy named Bob Herbert, very interesting figure, who was formerly a black man, not formerly, he is a black man, but formerly worked for the Daily News, and he sued them behind some old, you know, racist BS, and wound up on the Times editorial board later in later years. He just wrote a piece on this. he's been writing some really interesting stuff, high-level, thoughtful stuff on this whole matter. Because, I mean, people got to know this. What's the quote from Hillary? I've been increasing my influence among hard-working, that is, white. These are her words. That is white. What does that say about this Hillary Clinton character? Hard working, that is white. Wow, it's embarrassing.
And I know any blacks that, you know, are temporarily holding support for her have to be thoroughly embarrassed.
L A last S H last show about the reforming the last Sunday we did a show with Frank's ear, nose and throat doctor that Frank Frank has known for 20 some years, the subject how to reform the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. So Frank had a lot of ideas that he would talk about, and Dr. Richard Karbabas is his name, would flesh them out and support them and back them up as very workable and doable things and kind of fill in all the actual factual stuff from his 20 plus years of being a doctor.
That's interesting.
And it was, you know, a really, everything just seemed so clear, you know, just hearing the two of them talk for an hour and 45 minutes. And then Dr. Karbabas pulls out this graph he got online where he takes all these issues about the healthcare reform. This is what McCain says. This is what Obama says. This is what Clinton says. Well, after an hour and 45 minutes of this conversation, it all seemed like gobbledygook. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, what are they talking about? So that was a bit of a like, you know. But the actual conversation that these guys had made it seem like it was very doable.
Well, it is. It's just the question is, who's going to lead the fight to expropriate the health monster, you know?
Right.
And that's what people don't want to do. So it's an American phenomenon. You can't even pose the question clearly, because to ask the question clearly answers it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we got a problem then.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
Okay. And I don't know if Gerald said it the way that he wanted to say it, but the answer to any solution is always in the question.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
It's always in the question. So some of the things that people are posing to the candidates there, the questions have no answer. So if you don't bring a question to the table that can be packaged and answered, then there's no answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the social questions that are being asked these days they're so nebulous. There's so much vapor involved in the question. You can't get a substantive answer.
Right. That's what about that. Yeah, that was my experience completely with the healthcare thing. You know, I'm like sitting there after this conversation, like, I want to hear what they have to say. And it was like, you know, it just spaced me out immediately. It just didn't make any sense. It was like gobbledygook. It just seemed like gobbledygook.
Don't ask me what's it like after death. Do you have anything quantifiable or qualifiable to ask that question? I mean, why speculate about something that you have no information? You can't even package that. There are no paradigms for a question such as that.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you or anyone bring up a question in the social realm for something that can't be answered, that's unknowable at that time? And too many of these things happen day in, day out, for generations, and people know they're answering a question that is unanswerable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ask a question that
is unanswerable. That's a method, though. They do that on purpose because to keep people's minds off of things that could be solved, like health care, like all kind of things. You know, and it's conscious.
A. Easy.
So what's
easier,
life going to be like for you, Gerald?
Easy. I. L. L. I. Easily. That could be solved easily.
Yeah. That's right. But, you know, part of the problem is the American people themselves. We got to quit faking this now. You know, people have to want better. And let's not kid ourselves here. I mean, I understand the manipulation, the dumbing down of America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, people have to take some responsibility for this voting for these folks, for keeping this stuff going. Because this thing, you talking about this fuel, it's not just the fuel. We have a problem with the planet. Our whole conception and the way that people look at the planet is so skewed that people can't begin to understand. Okay, we got to change. We got to try some. No, they can't get it. They don't get it. And for those who want to know more about, you know, what I was saying, what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to convey, there is an excellent film by the ex-former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore, called, and I help me out if I get, don't get it right, The Inconvenient Truth, I think it's called.
Right.
Very good piece. Worthwhile piece. And then you understand. So it's not just, it's just a whole way that Americans, unfortunately, approach stuff. And I think, I think it starts with slavery. It's that deeply rooted. The inability to think consistently and logically begins with that. And then if you don't heal that and you build on that, that rotten foundation, you're in a situation today where the dollar, as far as I understand, is not backed by silver or gold.
Well, I'm going to bring it up a little bit and leave it at that.
Go.
I go with Huey's PhD statement. Huey said all of Western thought, period. All of Western thought is gibberish. Whatever it's founded upon, everything, all the European greats, outside of the science, outside of the hard sciences, all there, all of the political sciences, social sciences, psychological sciences, based on gibberish, because none of it applies to the people of color. None of it applies. I have my degree in applied psychology. It doesn't apply to, none of it applies to the children of color that I deal with. It doesn't. The culture of psychology doesn't apply to none of them. It's not relevant to them. And that's just saying. And Huey said that back in 78. Here it is, 2008. If he was saying that Western thought was gibberish back then, and in order for me to get a degree in applied psychology, and finding that is not applicable, I stand there on the corner, standing in the classroom, trying to apply some of those ideas. They look at me like I lost my goddamn mind, like they do. Okay, so my approach doesn't come from the classroom.
That
my approach comes from an understanding applied from my cultural and historical understandings.
That is a B, E, beginning of A, O, other show.
All right. That very good, Frank.
So let's give you. All right, I am V, O, T. I am voting for you. We saw that you're running. You're running for office. Did you know that?
No.
Yes, you're in our ballot. Peace and Freedom Party.
Y'all crazy as hell.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I thought you guys weren't running in the Peace and Freedom Party.
No, but we're voting for you in that category. That.
Lord have mercy, bless their souls.
You didn't even know it, huh?
No. Oh boy. That's see, y'all. I'm not. Not now. I'll tell you.
All right. So we should, they should say their names, right? Say your names before we sign off.
Okay. I'm old Corporal Gerald Smith. Signing out, y'all. See you later, Berkeley.
All right. Steve.
And I'm Steve McCutcheon, John and Pat's oldest boy. My pen name, Lil Masai. Baltimore chapter, Oakland Black Panther Party.
All right. S. E-E-C, if they C-O, come, B, come back, to G-R, grill me. See, everybody, you'll see if they come back to grill Frank on his platform. Keep an eye. Okay, good night.
Okay. Yeah. Now, check this out.